Good morning. I am so honored and excited to be here today with the most incredible poet and author, Maggie Smith.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. I am so excited about your book and to share about your book. But I read on Instagram, is it really true? It's your seventh book, but your first book tour where you're actually going to be in person?
The first few books I published were books of poems with small presses, and they don't send you on a book tour. So I started out sort of like, loading books into a canvas tote in my car and driving and doing like bookstore readings or house readings. But this is the first time that I actually get to go on an honest to goodness fly from place to place book tour. The last few books all came out during sort of peak pandemic.
Peak pandemic is a good term. I generally say we've been riding on the COVID coaster.
Yeah, I'm like reticent to talk about it in past tense because it's not past tense, but of course it's not quite what it was 3 years ago either. So yeah, we're coming up with language for it, aren't we?
Yes, you're right. It's absolutely not past tense. I feel like we've been riding the highs and the lows, and I love that you brought that up about creating language for it, because I feel like reading your memoir, there's so much in the way you designed it that's structured of the poem. Can you talk a little bit about, I felt like I got so much information as I was reading with the chapter titles and which things repeated but still change. It was almost like a chorus of a song.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, I'm a big fan of sort of offering the reader a breadcrumb trail or two or three in a book, because as a reader, whether it's poetry or prose, I really love those moments of recognition where I see something I think I've seen before, and it gives me a chance to kind of make connections. And for me, at least as a writer, writing a memoir was all about making connections both between past experiences and present time, and also parts of my life, like how the writer part of my life relates to the mothering part of my life, or the wife part of my life, or daughter, or friend, or all of these different aspects of what it is to be a human being. And so that's the part of that, the desire to use repetition in that way was just to speak to the truth of the experience, which is we tend to not think of life or remember things in a straight line. We tend to kind of come back, ideas tend to echo or remind us of other things. We tend to reflect in a way or ruminate in a way that makes things kind of return and return and return. And so the form for me was probably the most psychologically true way I could present the story.
You shared a lot about, what it's like, not just the experience of, the changes in life of meeting someone and deciding to spend life together or deciding not to spend life together, but also so much about the career and how that worked. And I love that in a way your memoir, you talk about not being a tell-all, tell mine. But also the way you really spoke to the reader. I felt like there was a lot of like breaking the fourth wall of just like, okay, let me tell you where we are.
I started doing that fairly early on, and that's not something I typically do when I'm writing. And maybe it's just because this genre for me was new, so I was kind of making up my own rules as I went. But I really felt like I was, being vulnerable in the book and speaking directly to readers was a way of kind of acknowledging the vulnerability, and also just a way of acknowledging the reader's intelligence. Like, I know you're here reading this book with me, and there are going to be things you want to know about that I'm not sharing. And I respect you enough to acknowledge that. Like, we're in this together for the next 300 pages.
It's true. And I love when you felt very personable in it. Like, here's the boundary. And I think that helps readers to just say like, oh, I don't have to tell every story, and these are the parts, and the story's still very cohesive. So I think that's very lovely to see a memoir where it's not about oversharing, but it's about going on this journey together.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I agree. I mean, and I write about this in the book, like if there's one thing that my therapist says constantly, it's boundaries, boundaries, boundaries. Like, and I think not just in life, but in writing, you know, what do we owe the reader?
Mm-hmm.
And what do we get to keep to ourselves? And when we write about our lives, it's not a deposition, it's a memoir. Like, we don't actually owe every single detail to the reader. And some of the, I think, in fact, some of the, maybe the most powerful things that we can do for a reader is to give them the space to actually reflect on things and think about things and make connections to their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes pulling back is the way to allow that to happen.
Yes. I mean, like your title says, I do think you made this place beautiful and you did. There was space to follow along. And like I said, I like how you said about the breadcrumbs. To me, it felt more like the chorus of the song, like, okay, know where we are. And I thought that was beautiful. One of the things that I really related to that I think many humans will relate to is being in a relationship where you're, as good things happen, you're withholding them from your partner because it's not going so well. And I loved what you said about, you said, I stopped sharing good news. I made myself small, folded myself up, origami tight.
I think probably a lot of people will relate to that. And maybe women in particular. You know, the phrase, don't get too big for your britches, is not usually applied to men. And so, yeah, I think I see it as being gendered, although I realize that that's not always the case, that sometimes a partner might have, good news for them that they want to be family good news,
mm-hmm.
but because of the way that, or perhaps it inconveniences the other person, or perhaps because of whatever's going on in that person's professional mm-hmm. life, it's hard to hear. And I think we all hope that we will be able to accept a good news on behalf of our partner or best friend or sister. You know, when someone's like, oh, I met someone wonderful and you're single or just went through a breakup, you want to feel good for that person. If someone gets promoted and you just lost your job or feel like you're languishing in a job you don't love, you really, I think we're all hoping that we'll be, you know, quote, the bigger person. But it doesn't always happen. You know, life is complicated and it doesn't necessarily make us bad people when we can't just be wholeheartedly gung-ho happy for someone else, but it sure makes it hard to live together when you don't feel like someone is like cheering for you.
Absolutely. And I think that you had such good examples, like being at, you know, someone signing books and someone offering to take a photo and you're like, no, I don't need that help. Like that won't make things better for me. And
yeah.
Like I said, I think that's very relatable. And to your point, not oversharing.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. And I think you're right. I think that is something relatable, whether you're a writer or not, you know, whatever your sort of like success or shine moment is, you can tell a lot about any given relationship, parent, child, friend, neighbor, spouse, by the way they handle both your failures and your successes, you know, using that as a barometer, that can be really telling.
It can be. And I think it's a really great moment that other people can hold on to think about what happened the last time I shared good news or challenges and how did the person respond?
Yeah. And what about me? Like, how am I responding? You know, like that's, for me, that's always the most interesting thing is how can I not ever blame myself, but like on the other side of self-blame is personal accountability, right? Like there is a difference. And one thing I really worked hard to do in this book is take personal accountability for my own choices. And so I'm thinking about that too. Like, okay, if X really hurt me, I don't want to do that to someone else, right? So how do I check myself and my own ego or my own disappointment and make sure that I'm showing up for my people in a way that is, you know, wholehearted and generous even if there are parts of it that are difficult for me.
Yes. Yes. I think that's really true, is how do we show up as wholehearted? The other thing that struck me so much was when you talked about lonely versus alone. Mm-hmm. And you said, but feeling lonely when you're with your partner is worse than being alone. Being with someone who doesn't want the best for you is worse than being alone.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've talked to a lot of divorced people who will say the worst part wasn't the after, the worst part was when things weren't going well, because it is really lonely to feel a lack of connection in a relationship, especially if it's a long relationship and it seems like it should be different.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so if you are alone and you don't have any expectation of having a conversation with someone in the room because there's no one there, that feels different than being in a room with someone who's not engaging with you.
Absolutely. And,
yeah.
And if you're alone, you can make an active choice. I'm going to go skating.
Amen. I'm going to watch a movie. I'm going to bake. I'm going to put headphones on and listen to music and, you know, dust and pretend that's fun, because with anything with loud music is suddenly a party. Yeah. Or I'll leave the house because there's no one here. So I'm going to go find a friend and have a happy hour, or yes, roller skate if necessary and weather permits.
Right. But I think that's also about, in a way, the origami unfolding, that, you know, is are you folded in someone's foot is holding it all tamped down, or you're like, oh, I can change the shape.
Yeah. Yeah. How can I be? I mean, that's one thing. And I think it's one of the gifts of middle age. I mean, there are enough downsides. One of the gifts of middle age, I think, is learning how to be your whole self. And if I just wish, oh my gosh, like, you couldn't pay me to be a teenager again. You couldn't pay me to be in my 20s again. Yeah, my 30s were a little better, but I feel, and my mother has always told me this, the older you get, the more yourself you can be and the less you care about what other people think. And I do think that is a gift of aging, is just not only knowing your own worth and being able to sort of stand in your own power, but just not being so wrapped up in other people's opinions of you.
I think that is a huge advantage. And so talking about that makes me think about the review where someone said they were talking about reverse midlife crisis. I thought that was really, I do too. I'm trying to think if it feels the tiniest bit pejorative, like if there's another reframing of those words. Because I feel like midlife crisis has always been quite not something necessarily to strive for.
And I
get the reverse midlife crisis, like I've gotten to this place and I'm beginning again and it's beautiful and I'm opening up, but I'm just questioning the words. I do love the sentiment.
Yeah, I love it too. And I actually, as soon as I read that review, I went to, I do what I do, which is go to the dictionary and look up synonyms and antonyms. So I looked up, what is crisis, right? And it's like emergency, it's problem. And what is the opposite? What is an antonym for crisis? And it's like words like recovery and return. Mm. And so if the sort of memoir is chronicling a reverse or the opposite of a midlife crisis, to me, it's like a return to self, a midlife return to self. And that I love, you know, it makes a lot of sense. And the epigraph for the book actually plays perfectly into that, which is Emily Dickinson, I am out with lanterns looking for myself. And, you know, that's, I think, again, another opportunity that we have as we get older is to really think, okay, but who am I? What do I want? Not what do these other people want for me? Not what are the expectations for what I should be doing now, or what my career should look like, what my house should look like, what my kids should look like. What do I actually want? And can I make that for myself? Can I carve that out for myself? And so that's kind of how I read that, and it resonated with me.
Yeah, no, I loved it. I love what you did with that. And I also love in the book when you talk about the lanterns and about bringing the light, that you change the darkness just by entering it. And I think that's one of the challenges of memoir, is you often are going into a dark place in your in your life. Otherwise, you know, I don't know that people would be that interested in reading it. I believe this book is the top Goodreads expected book of the spring. Is that?
Goodness. I mean, I think it's been in there. It's been
most
one of the
anticipated.
Top,
that's yeah. the word. Most anticipated spring book. I mean, congratulations.
I'm glad. I mean, and that means a lot to me because that's readers. Mm-hmm. It's who's reading it to their to read pile. And so that means a lot if people are excited to read the book and are looking forward to it. That's great. That's great.
Yeah. I mean, I loved it. I think it was fantastic. And it was really helpful to me, like I said, in thinking about what I'm writing and obviously as being an accomplished poet and so supported by the country and Meryl Streep and all these poet organizations, not surprising that you were able to say things in such an incredible, your prose sounds like poetry to me.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I write everything as a poet. I can't, like, it's not a hat I can, like, put on and take off. So that's sort of just who I am, no matter what I'm writing. But that I'm glad that was your experience of the book.
Yes, and I mean, I'm so honored that you have a National Endowment for the Arts Creative Writing Fellowship, and you get to be here speaking to me. It's very exciting for me. And I also loved that I love things about language. So one of my favorite things being in Indonesia is the word East, Timor means East. So when you're in East Timor, you're in East East.
I see where this is going.
Yeah. So tell people, what was your thing about the words?
it's the Great River, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah. The Ohio River, Ohio itself means Great River. So the Ohio, when you say Ohio River, you're saying Great River.
I love things like that. Because
so do I. I'm a complete word nerd, as my kids will tell you. So yeah, any chance I have, even as you heard with midlife crisis, any chance I have to sort of look at the etymology of a word and the origins and sort of take it apart, that's like, I geek out about that stuff.
Well, but it's very interesting. Like,
I think so.
Well, good. If no one else does, that's too bad. We're still talking about it. The other thing, speaking about words, but is also the geography when you're talking about the ocean and how life is like the ocean and what the scientists found. So talk about that, about the new ocean.
Yeah, I just remember reading a news story and it's like, oh, well, we've added another ocean. And I was like, wait a minute, it's not like they just discovered it. It's not like some insect that's been located in the rainforest that we never knew existed. Although that happens too, which I love that we're still finding new species of things. But this is something that is like, it's an ocean, it's giant. It exists on maps. It's just been sort of combined with something else. It didn't have its own name. So it was lumped in, right? There's probably a marriage metaphor in there. It was lumped in with something else. And then at a certain point, they decided there was enough criteria, and I won't remember what it is, to give it its own name. And so this ocean got to be its own thing. And I thought, that feels like life. Like, you think it's one thing, it's sort of hiding in plain sight. And then over time, you realize, in fact, it was maybe something else. And you have different language for it and a different sense of recognition of what it is. And yet here we've all been looking at this thing all along.
I do think it's a marriage metaphor, because we're in a relationship, like you said, could be a family relationship with a parent or a spouse. And we think how things are going. And then at some point we think, no, that's not how it's going to keep going.
Yeah. I mean, any kind of change, it's like, oh, okay. So this is how it is. And maybe it's been like this for a while. You know, how far do I have to trace my steps back before it was like this? And there's often no easy answer for that kind of retracing to happen. Yeah.
No. Well, not easy and mostly not pleasant.
And probably not productive.
Yeah. Oh, okay. We'll go with that one also. but it makes me think about when you talk a couple times about the nesting dolls and how what's inside and what's outside and what do we see is somewhat like the ocean, right? Like you're saying, again, with, you know, maybe a species in the rainforest, it hasn't been recorded, but we weren't looking at it. Whereas with the oceans, you think about how many times we look at those weather maps when they're saying, you know, this front is coming in, and all of a sudden, like, oh no, that's not the name.
So much of life is hiding in plain sight. And until we have the opportunity or are forced to sort of reevaluate and sort of recalibrate things, mm-hmm. sometimes we don't actually see as clearly as we think we do. And so that's, in some ways, it's a perk. It's a bonus. Like, I think seeing clearly is a wonderful thing. Even if the thing that comes into focus is painful, it's still a gift to see it clearly. Like, understanding, a gift. Mm. Even if it's hard, it's still a gift.
And often it's hard. And like you said, the beginning of your book starts with the quote about the lantern. So bringing the light. And in this season, we have Passover, we have Easter, we have spring, there's more light. So it's such a beautiful time for your book to come out.
I agree. I think that spring is such a time of renewal, you know, a time where like everything looks so dormant and gray, especially yes. here in Ohio. Everything just sort of is like gray and wet and just sad and overcast and cold for months and months and months. And then spring happens, and it seems like overnight, all the trees are in bloom and it's warm and the sun, actually, you can feel it on your face. And that sort of like the spring in us, you know, when you feel like you've been a little dormant for a while, and then you can sort of feel that change happening. You mm-hmm. feel like you're turning into a kind of a new season in your life. I mean, that, thank goodness for like the personal springs.
Yes. So if people are ready to read your memoir and get involved in this incredible book, tell them, where can they find the book and how can they find you? What's the best ways to find you?
Yeah. I mean, I always encourage people to shop at independent bookstores. So anywhere books are sold, any independent bookstore should be able to get it in for you. Or if you like to order books online, bookshop.org actually, you know, gives some money to independent bookstores and will ship right to your house. So I think that's a good sort of compromise way to do it. I am at maggiesmithpoet.com. That's my website, so that people don't confuse me with the dame. and I'm Maggie Smith Poet on social media, again, because I'm the poet. I'm not the incredible British actress. And so that's a good way for people to find me.
Okay, good. Well, we'll put that in the notes from the podcast, and everybody should right now go out and get You Could Make This Place Beautiful. I loved your book, and it's really been so lovely and such an honor to hear more from you. And I can't wait for everyone to respond and say how much they loved your book as much as I did.
Oh, well, thanks for having me, Lisa.